Hi, all of you wonderful scuba divers out there. Welcome to Scuba Diver Magazine podcast, where I break down the latest scuba diving news and just things that have piqued my interest over the past week. This week, we saw the passing of another scuba diving legend. Last week, we had a deep diving pioneer who passed away. This week, it was Bob Hollis. And there's also a way that you can help out in an upcoming Divers Alert Network study. Yeah, late last week, news broke of the passing of Bob Hollis, of obviously Hollis, but also Oceanic and a few others. He passed away on the 4th of January in Salt Lake City, Utah, with his family by his side. And Huish Outdoors released this obituary information about Bob. So, born on the 25th of April, 1937, in Orland, in California, to Robert and Eleanor Hollis, Bob leaves behind a legacy as a pioneer, entrepreneur, businessman, and most importantly, a loving father and grandfather. Bob accomplished more in 85 years than most and lived his life to the fullest. He was a risk taker who truly did what he loved and inspired others to do the same. If there wasn't a way, then he created one. Bob will be remembered by many as a groundbreaking influence in both the sport of scuba diving and underwater photography. Bob's love of the ocean began in 1955 after reading an article about underwater exploration in Popular Mechanics. Following his first scuba experience, Bob became obsessed with the water, becoming one of the earliest underwater photographers on the West Coast and establishing the Underwater Photographic Society of Northern California in 1966. Additionally, Bob was appointed to the advisory board of the Underwater Parks and Reserves, California State Parks Department, where he assisted in exploring the coastline and identifying future areas for preservation, including Point Lobos, La Jolla, and the Salt Point State Park. A true entrepreneur, when Bob realized that the scuba diving and photography equipment available at the time did not meet his needs, he set about developing his own. All of this was done whilst Bob continued to attend school for business and engineering and worked at Standard Oil to support his young family. In 1966, Bob opened the Anchor Shack Dive Shop in Hayward, California, and began developing underwater camera housing, strobes, and hand lights, which served as the jumping-off point for his company, Oceanic. By 1976, the Oceanic product line had completely developed, ultimately turning Bob and the Oceanic brands into leaders in the diving community. Over the course of his lifetime, Bob founded many companies, including American Underwater Products, AUP, Pelagic Pressure Systems, Romy Enterprises, and the renowned scuba diving brands Oceanic, Hollis, and Aeris. Bob wanted everyone to experience scuba diving and gave thousands around the world the opportunity to do so. Using his experience, Bob helped create an underwater saturation system in 1978 for the Andrea Doria shipwreck. The system was attached to the wreck at the depth of 73 meters for up to 7 days, allowing divers to explore the wreck for several days without having to swim back to the surface. Bob logged more dives than anyone on the wreck, and in 1981 served as the underwater photographer for the nationally aired film called Andrea Doria, The Final Chapter, detailing the team's goal of recovering the bank safe from the famed sunken Italian ocean liner. In addition to developing photography and scuba diving equipment, Bob was also responsible for leading some of the first dive trips to Cozumel, the Bahamas, the Virgin Islands, Belize, Yucatan Peninsula, and Galapagos. He also led tours to the remote destination of Papua New Guinea, where he later built a family home and destination dive resort for other underwater enthusiasts. Over his storied career, Bob received many awards and achievements, including the Nogi Award, the DEMA Reaching Out Award, and was an inductee of the Scuba Diving Hall of Fame. Throughout all of his professional success, Bob's greatest achievement was his family, including his children Debbie, Mike, Nick, and Zach, grandchildren Heather, Elizabeth, Jonathan, Caitlin, Robert, Seth, Preston, Olivia, and Sloan, and great-grandchildren Benjamin, Natalie, Henry, Eleanor, Samuel, Ian, and Colin. Bob shared his passion passion of the ocean and traveling the world with them, including abalone diving trips on the California coast, family liveaboard dive trips, motorcycle adventures, and creating memories for many lifetimes. He will be deeply missed by his family and friends. The family will be holding private services in Orland, California, and ask for those interested in honoring Bob to share your stories and photos via social media. If you would like to also share those with the family, they can be sent to bobhollisfamily@gmail.com. And in lieu of flowers, please donate to an ocean conservation charity in Bob's memory. And now that we're in 2023, this year marks Dan Europe's 40th anniversary. So the Divers Alert Network Europe has been helping divers since 1983, when a group of passionate divers and diving physicians started an international non-profit medical and research organization dedicated to the health and safety of the global diving community. But what's also good is there's a new study that you can help out with if you want to. It's a new bubble study, inter and intra-subject variability in post-dive venous gas emboli. So VGE or venous gas emboli are bubbles that can appear in the blood after a dive due to decompression. These bubbles are detectable using ultrasound imaging and provide a measure of decompression stress. VGE appear at different rates, both for different divers and for the same divers on different days, but reasons for variations in VGE and decompression stress have yet to be identified. In this study, Dan researchers are going to collect data on participants diving the same dive profile each week for 6 weeks in a row to determine how much variation exists within and between divers, and to try to attempt to narrow down what factors contribute to increased decompression stress. So if you are interested in participating, you can contact Dan at research@dan.org or join one of the informational meetings. I'll put a link down below. There's a couple meetings in mid to late January. And you can also sign up for one of those information sessions. Again, I'll put the link down below. So I think this is in the States. I forget exactly where. Let me see if I can try and find it. It's not going to tell me. Typical. But yeah, if you are available and you do want to help them out, it's a 6 week study. So, six dive days, to evaluate individual VGE susceptibility in the absence of repeated diving. And they basically just want to, they know that these bubbles appear, but they don't really know why they appear and what the factors are, whether it's depth or how quickly you ascended or whatever it was. So they're going to do certain dive profiles, and they want as many different test subjects as possible. And then afterwards, they'll just use the ultrasonic scanner to see what's going on. So if you are available, click the link down in the description below, and you can contribute to scuba diving science. And while we're on the subject of decompression and scuba diving, there's an important notice that's been put out for scuba divers who are diving around the Solomon Islands. So the only hyperbaric chamber in the Solomon Islands is currently out of commission. So the statement says, please note that the only hyperbaric chamber located in Solomon Islands is currently out of commission following damage caused during a recent earthquake. This means that the closest hyperbaric chamber location is Australia. So it is imperative that anyone wishing to come to the Solomon Islands to enjoy their destination's world ranking scuba diving must have Dan or some other form of cover that would cater to emergency medevac transfers to Australia. All Solomon Island-based dive operators adhere to strict international dive safety protocols, but not all operators have the insurance to cover individuals in the case of a dive-related incident. So for individuals' additional protection, personal cover is essential. So if you're out there at the moment, or you're traveling out there over the next few days or weeks, it's definitely worth double checking and investing in some dive insurance, because that's going to be a fairly expensive bill to medevac you from the Solomon Islands over to Australia, and then the hyperbaric medical treatment. So if you are heading out there, just double check your policy and check the hyperbaric chamber just to see when it's back up and running. Technical diving guru Paul Toomer has announced that he has stepped aside as president of Dive Raid International, the training agency, to take up new duties as VP Product Development and Member Relations, effective immediately. So in this new role, Paul will assist PJ Prinsloo in the training department, developing new courses and updating to the more than 120 programs the agency currently offers. Paul will also be heading up the new training advisory group at RAID. This group has been set up to give professional advice to RAID's executives whilst helping to keep the standards current and the new courses relevant in the recreational scuba, freediving, technical and rebreather markets. The popular and well-known diving personality, Paul, one of the original founders of RAID and a current partner in Dive Raid International, said, "Prior to taking on the president's job, under the previous company ownership, I thrived as director diver training. It was a job that I loved, and I'm very happy to think that I'll be involved once more in training department business. As the agency has expanded its reach during the past 12 months, keeping up with the daily demands of our membership worldwide has more than doubled because our network of dive centers and professionals has grown. And so I'm excited that this new position means I'll be able to share some of that workload and keep the level of customer service among the highest in the industry." So Paul is a well-respected technical diver and explorer. He's a lovely guy. Explained that in this new role, he'll have more time once again to participate in more diving expeditions and to focus on market pressures. He's felt to run various training programs, including instructor and instructor trainer level courses. He added, "Under the new management team, RAID is more stable now than it ever has been. And on a personal note, as the company moves forwards in 2023, I'll be able to spend more time with my family and on personal projects without negatively affecting its continued growth. This is a perfect balance for me and for RAID." So it's nice to see that he's just kind of shifting position at RAID, and that RAID itself is growing, because they're a relatively new training agency compared to like PADI or SSI and all that. But they very comprehensive courses. I remember taking a couple of courses when I first met Paul, and yeah, even as an instructor, you're looking at some of these questions and you're like, wow, these are really comprehensive, and they do put you through your paces. They have so many different courses. They did something incredible during lockdown. They basically released all of their training information and manuals for all of their courses, because they figured, whilst people can't leave their homes and whatnot and can't go scuba diving, then at least they can just read and catch up on any of our training materials. And that was a wonderful thing for them to do, so that if you wanted to maybe move into a different area, different speciality, then you could just have a look through the course materials. If you wanted to brush up on your existing skills, then that was all there. And because they're all digital, they don't produce hard copy textbooks. It's all digital, so it's far friendlier for the environment. And to be able to update them is much quicker and easier. It's one of these newer, more dynamic training agencies. I just found that quite interesting news. In Thailand, a scuba diver has gone missing after a solo descent. So this is a Romanian man who had not previously scuba dived beyond 18 meters, has gone missing in Thailand after descending solo to free an anchor that was snagged at around 30 meters. A search operation is underway for 46-year-old Sebastian Emil Somersan after he failed to return to his speedboat, which was moored near an island off Phuket on the 8th of January. The diver lives on Phuket, He left the beach at 9 a.m. to go scuba diving off the island with a Romanian friend. A Thai woman had accompanied them as well. The two men had completed one dive, but Summerson had entered the water again after finding that the anchor was stuck when they prepared to move. According to the mayor of the nearest town, Summerson had not dived beyond 18 meters before, so it must have been like open water qualified. But when he failed to return to the boat, the friend had called his wife at around 12:45 to ask her to contact the local lifeguard service. They had responded using a RIB and jet skis, but were soon joined by a team made up of Defence Force volunteers, Marine Police, Army personnel, and local professional divers. As of yet, I don't think he's been found. The local governor of Phuket has said that there are still strong currents in the area, even though they're at the end of the monsoon season. So they're theorising that he went down to free the anchor and got caught in a current and was dragged far from the scene. So hopefully this story is going to have a happy ending, and he has like surfaced, but the currents just pulled him away, and he's either like washed up on an island, and he's just waiting for rescue. And the final news story is a bit closer to home here in the UK. A sunfish has washed ashore on a beach in Norfolk, being the most recent of several arrivals in this phenomenon that experts have attributed to the heating up of the seas. So sunfish or mola mola are the very unusual, very vertical fish, and they have two fins. Well, they have two main fins, one at the top, one at the bottom. They're a very weird, like discus shaped fish, and yeah, they're washing up on the shores of the UK, and not just the UK, it's actually on the like east coast or even the southeast coast of the UK. So they're coming from much warmer waters. They're managing to either get all the way around the top of Scotland and back down, or they're going through the channel and then kind of getting lost in the North Sea. Now, this isn't anything like vastly unusual. We tend to see a few of these every now and then throughout the year, but they're in no way endemic to our waters. And yeah, experts are kind of like, they're not confirming it, they're just suggesting it's probably due to, you know, global warming and rising sea temperatures. So the actual sunfish itself was a relatively young sunfish. From the tip of the top fin to the tip of the bottom fin, it measured 1.5 meters, and they can grow to like three times that quite easily. It washed up on North Beach in Great Yarmouth, and a doctor from the University of East Anglia said that it was the fourth sunfish to have washed up on Norfolk's beaches in the last 12 months. And he told the BBC that we don't know why they died, and this is a ongoing research project, but it's incredibly important as we know so little about them. He goes on to say that they have washed up on the Norfolk coast before, maybe once every 10 years or so, but to have four in the last 12 months is really interesting. We don't have the evidence to say it is related to climate change, but no one's denying that the oceans are changing. So it was actually found by a photographer called Catherine Hawkins, who was on a New Year's Day walk with her family when she spotted the creature in the sand. At first, she said she thought it could be a seal pup because it's quite dark black kind of coloration. And as they got closer, they realized what it was. And they figure it's likely to have died from a lack of food and the cold temperatures of the North Sea. But yeah, it's quite interesting to see that we're getting like more and more of these more exotic fish species in our waters around the UK. Normally, it's fairly humble creatures. I mean, we get all sorts of nudibranchs and interesting, colourful stuff. But it's, I mean, I've never seen a sunfish. I think they saw humpback whales off of the southwest, like Cornwall, the other week. So yeah, maybe we're going to get some more like interesting species that we're going to run across in our British waters. And yeah, it's by the sounds of it, they're like really at the edge of their like range, because marine biologists think that it basically, yeah, it got too cold and it ran out of food and it effectively died and then washed up on the sea. But it does mean that the, sorry, washed up on the beach, but it does mean that there are probably others that are surviving to a certain degree in and around our waters. So yeah, maybe this summer is going to be a bit more interesting around the waters of the UK. Onto new dive gear that's been spotted. So the first one is a new Aqualung regulator that I believe was spotted at the Paris Dive Show last week. And it's basically the Helix regulator, which is like a replacement of their core regulator, except this one has a breathing adjustment knob on the side. Normally the Helix and the Helix Pro, you just have the Venturi switch, but this new one that was photographed by someone, I couldn't find who, it was just on social media. It has the same like ratchet gear face to it, but now it has, yeah, a breathing adjustment knob. So, That's all I could find out about it. I couldn't find anything on Aqualung's website or on their like social media. So that's probably going to be announced fairly soon, ready for the new diving season. I don't know what they're going to call it, like the Helix Master or something, because we already have the Helix and the Helix Pro. Helix Pro is cold water rated, whereas the Helix is less cold water rated. I think that's the main difference between the two, other than the colour of the face. But I think the main point is the cold water rating. And Scuba Pro have a new regulator out. It's the R105. So this looks to replace the R095, their like basic second stage. They've paired it up with a Mark II Evo, which is their like entry level piston first stage. But this R05, I quite like the style to it, is if it's got a matte rubberized finish to the front cover, and it's got that kind of retro like style. They've been doing this over the past few years where they're going back to their like almost 70s kind of style, just with little touches here and there. So this has a like a ring of blue and a couple of stripes of blue in that matte black finish, which gives it a slight retro twist. But yeah, this looks to I think it's going to replace the R095, and it's probably going to sit just under their R195, which is probably going to keep going. And yeah, it's just a simple second stage. From what I can tell, it looks reversible as well. So as like a backup regulator, and if you need the hose to route in from the other side, it's perfect. Cold water rated as well. It's got the Extis protection on that first stage, and yeah, it just looks like a tough yet simple second stage, something that'll get the job done. And here it has this anti-scratch front cover and a metal barrel on the inside, which is quite nice. Normally on these like real basic second stages, they don't even have a barrel. It's just a very basic spring valve on the inside. But now that it's reversible, yeah, you have this metal barrel, which is pretty cool. Otherwise, I was having a look around, and Cressy has a new website, which is pretty snazzy. They've updated it, or they've at least updated the English version that I automatically go to. They've got a few new bits and bobs on the website, dive computers, and I think I saw a new BCD as well. New website is always interesting, because I know just how much work goes into the back end of websites, and how much time is spent trying to make them look and work just right on different screen sizes and whatnot. As far as YouTube, so a few videos have gone live recently. The first one is it's kind of a repeat, and I saw that someone got a little upset because so basically this came from a question on Ask Mark, and I answered that and released that on Ask Mark, but I figured that other people are probably going to it'll basically make for a better video if I can spend a bit more time on it. So spent a bit more time, did a bit more B-roll footage for it, and I turned how a pre-dive switch works into a slightly more comprehensive video. And yeah, it's a bit of a repeat of an earlier video, but it's a better video to explain how pre-dive switches work. As far as Ask Mark, they're still vertical for a little while, but I have been going back to horizontal just because scuba divers never like change. But so many people were saying how they dislike the vertical format when it's on YouTube. So it's like, okay, fine, I'll just go back to horizontal. It's not that hard to render it in a different on a different plane. But yeah, I made a handful of them in vertical, so they're going to continue for another like week or so, but they're going to go back to horizontal before long if you dislike the vertical. As far as actual questions, the first one was asking about dive knives and traveling with planes, because with like airport security and that not, how are they going to take to like trying to get a knife on board? It's a matter of, obviously you can't take it as carry-on. That's going to be a no-brainer. But you can check it. And if you're checking it, as long as it's with like a bunch of dive equipment, then they're usually fine with it. I don't think I've ever had an issue with a dive knife. I mean, when I'm traveling, I tend to avoid like any of the huge, great big like Rambo-style dive knives because they're just so excessive for what most recreational scuba divers need. But no, I've never had an issue with a dive knife and like security checks and whatnot. The main thing, as I said earlier, is just to make sure that it's kind of surrounded by other scuba diving equipment. If it's just like your dive knife in a bag, that's kind of tricky, or like in a bag just with like clothes and your wash bag or whatever. That's kind of tricky to explain, but if it's got like a mast and fins and a wetsuit and whatnot, then yeah, it is far easier to understand. And the same when traveling by car. I mean, here in the UK, knife laws are quite strict, but as long as you have like a legitimate purpose, then it's far easier to explain yourself out of it with law enforcement. So yeah, if you're pulled over and you have like a knife in the glove box or something, then yeah, they're going to take that off you and you're going to get charged with something. But if it's in a kit bag with a whole bunch of scuba equipment, then yeah, you can explain that quite easily because it comes down to like sporting equipment. So yeah, they're not going to take it off you unless you are like particularly shifty. It's more about the knife being a safety tool for scuba diving as opposed to like an aggressive weapon or anything. So yeah, just have it with a bunch of other dive equipment and then yeah, you should be able to sort of explain yourself out of that one. The next question was about is it worth running a second low-pressure inflator hose to inflate DSMBs? And I've seen divers do this before. As far as like pros and cons, the pros are, one, you don't have to disconnect your BCD or, God forbid, your dry suit to inflate like a closed cell DSMB. A lot of divers nowadays, they just orally inflate them anyway. That's why the Apex DSMB has like an oral like nozzle to be able to blow into the DSMB as opposed to the metal like fitting for a BCD. But it's a very quick and easy way to inflate a DSMB just by using a low pressure inflator hose. And yeah, it can be a bit of a pain to disconnect hoses, especially if you're wearing gloves. I mean, it was a required skill that I had to teach a lot of students. And when a low pressure inflator hose is pressurized, you kind of have to push the hose into the inflator and then pull back that collar to be able to disconnect it. And that can be quite tricky for some divers. So yeah, I do get why you'd want to use a second dedicated low pressure inflator hose. And the main downsides to it are, okay, you're probably going to get some contaminants in and around the Schrader valve, so you do have to wash it a bit more thoroughly, and you also get an extra hose that you do have to like manage because you've got a lot kind of going over your left-hand shoulder. If you're trying to like find a certain particular hose, now you have an extra one to organize. I mean, that's not the end of the world, but it is just an additional thing to consider. But yeah, I've certainly seen a lot of divers use it, and I tend to use my my inflator hose to inflate a DSMB because it's so quick, it's so effortless, and it means that the DSMB is fully inflated by the time it reaches the surface. Because even if you fill it like two thirds, because it's ascending up in the water column, that air volume is just doubling in size from 10 meters. It's far easier to do that than to put like one breath of air in and then breathe from a second stage and then put another one in. Yeah. I mean, but to get back to the question, yeah, it's fine to run an extra low pressure inflator hose. It can be done. And yeah, there's no like substantial downside to it. This week, I've been working on a top 10 video for cylinders. I was trying to work out a way how I could make a top 10 like dive cylinders, because I was looking at like what I've done previously. I've done like masks. I think I've done fins. I've done dry suits and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, what else could I do? I've done torches. I've done knives and whatnot. And I was just looking through the different like equipment categories, and it was like cylinders. I was like, how can I make a video on top 10 cylinders without just being, oh, here's a 10 liter, here's a 12 liter. And I was just thinking about different cylinders, and I was like, oh, you know what? I know quite a few like interesting facts and like things about cylinders that I can probably make a top 10 out of that. And I did. So the interesting ones are like the colors of dive cylinders actually mean something. So the problem is it's different countries. You have like international ISO codes for gas cylinder contents, and we're not quite as strict as we could be compared to like other compressed gas industries. But if you've ever looked at a cylinder and it's got like black and white quarters or stripes around the shoulders of the cylinders, well, black is, oh, let me get this the right way around. Black is nitrogen and white is oxygen. So black and white quarters is a mixture of nitrogen and oxygen, which is basically air. And in the States, they do it slightly differently. So oxygen is yellow, and if it's compressed, then it's, you get that green diamond. So you get the green and the yellow diamond, and that's why nitrox colors are always yellow and green. And just little things like that. It's quite interesting to actually look at cylinders and kind of go, oh, you know what? Yeah, most of them are white and yellow to denote like breathing gas and whatnot. So yeah, I just thought that was quite interesting, as well as like aluminium cylinders. Some of them, because of their buoyancy, they actually float towards the end of the dive, and you can get to a state where the diving cylinder is completely neutrally buoyant depending on how much gas you breathed out of it, because air has some weight to it. Not a lot, but it does have some weight to it, especially when compressed. So when you're taking a whole ton of gas and you're compressing it down into this cylinder, you're actually adding a bit of weight to that cylinder, and it's enough to make it negatively buoyant when it's full. But then as you breathe it down and you expel all of this gas out of it, it actually becomes neutrally buoyant and then positively buoyant. So I mean, I've seen it. It's on Inner Space Explorers, ISE, on their YouTube channel. They actually let go of their like stage cylinders, and like after they breathe them down, and they're like, well, yeah, we dive with all of these gas mixes and all of these cylinders. it gets a bit clunky to keep carrying them all, especially when some of them are empty and positively buoyant, so they're wanting to float up, that they actually disconnect them and then let go of them. You watch this cylinder and regulator float up to the surface, and one of their buddies who's on a boat in the area just goes and picks them up. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, eight other things about diving cylinders. But I think that's about it that I've been working on this week. I'm still working on trying to get rid of this cough. It's just lingering, and that annoying cough that just kind of hovers around, which for like normal work, it's perfectly fine. But when you have to talk for a living, it can be quite annoying. So if the podcasts seem a bit like jumpy and jittery at points, it's basically me just cutting out coughs, unfortunately, like there, for example. But that's all that's piqued my interest this week. So thank you for listening, everybody. And if you've seen anything interesting, by all means, head over to YouTube and either send me a link or something, and or let me know, and I'll mention it in the next podcast. But yeah, that's it for another week. Head over to the website, Scuba Diver Magazine, and to like check out all the interesting things that we're doing over there. I'm still trying to get my hands on an Apex DSX dive computer. I might email him after this just to see sort of what's going on, because I know there are some in the country. I just need to get my hands on them so I can show you wonderful divers how it works and whether it's worth investing in. But thanks for listening, everybody. If you can, give it a thumbs up or whatever it is. Remember to subscribe and all that. Thank you for listening, and of course, safe diving.